laughter it elicited. 7. Worrying about the PowerPoint presentation you've got to give tomorrow. 8. Worrying about your daughter in preschool, or feeling guilty about not having called your aging mother yesterday. 9. Being annoyed that your so-called friend couldn't do you a favor of the sort you routinely do for him or her. 10. Looking forward to the upcoming dinner with another friend at which you can vent about the first friend, and so on. There are three recurring themes here. First, these thoughts involve the past and future, not the present. The one thing you're not doing while having these thoughts is paying attention to what's actually going on in the real world at this moment. Second, all of these thoughts involve you. By default, we think mainly self-referential thoughts. This is unsurprising, given that natural selection designed the brain to focus on our interests, at least our interests as natural selection defined them. Third, most of these thoughts involve other people. This too is unsurprising, given what social animals people are. Indeed, it turns out there's a fair amount of overlap between the default mode network and what brain scans have identified as the theory of mind network, the part of the brain involved in thinking about what other people are thinking. There's also a fourth theme here, a fourth thing that almost all of these mental meanderings have in common. Can you spot it? Hint. What were the previous two chapters of this book about? Exactly. Modules. Though the trains of thought that carry you away from direct experience can take you to lots of different places, pretty much all of those places seem to lie within the province of one of these sort of mental modules I've already described, which is to say, modules that make perfect sense in evolutionary terms. Modules that deal with attracting mates, keeping them, enhancing your status, which can mean derogating rivals, taking care of kin, tending to your friendships, which includes making sure they are reciprocal and that you're not getting exploited, and so on. The one glaring exception, the one thought in the list above that doesn't seem to fit naturally into a major module, is number 5. Looking forward to that beer you so richly deserve. Presumably, evolution didn't build a beer-drinking module into us. But beer, like many other recreational drugs, is an invention that circumvents evolution's logic. It taps directly into the reward center that normally would be activated more arduously by doing things that helped our ancestors spread their genes. When your mind is wandering, it may feel like, well, like your mind is wandering, like it's strolling along the landscape of modules and sampling them, indulging one module for a while, then eventually moving on to another one. But another way to describe it is to say that actually, the different modules are competing for your attention, and when the mind wanders from one module to another, what's actually happening is that the second module has acquired enough strength to wrestle control of your consciousness away from the first module. Far be it from me to insist that you accept one or the other of these ways of looking at mind wandering. For now, I just make 2 points. 1. Psychologists who adhere to the modular model of the mind tend toward the second view, the idea that the conscious you isn't choosing modules so much as being commandeered by modules that have prevailed over competing modules, and thus, as Gazzaniga put it in Chapter 6, won the prize of conscious recognition. 2. If you do go on a Vipassana meditation retreat and slowly, haltingly, get better at focusing on your breath, you will probably lean increasingly toward the second hypothesis. It will seem more and more like your mind isn't wandering within its own terrain so much as being hijacked by intruders. And eventually, these won't seem so much like hijackings as attempted hijackings. Thoughts will arise, but they won't hold your attention for quite so long before you return to your breath. They'll fail to carry you away, The train will pull into the station, and you'll watch it leave without ever getting on it. Actually, I shouldn't have written that last sentence with such authority, as if I often watch with utter detachment whole trains of thought pull into the station and then leave. My typical experience is more like getting on the train and then, after it's left the station and is picking up speed, realizing I don't want to be on it and jumping off. This has been something of a frustration for me. On the one hand, I've gotten reasonably good at viewing my feelings with some objectivity, actually watching them arise as if I were watching some character walk on stage. At least I'm pretty good at this while meditating. In everyday life, my record is more mixed. But I find it harder to view my thoughts with such detachment. To put my problems another way, remember when Gazzaniga said that the thought you're conscious of at any given moment is the thought that comes bubbling up? Well, I've had trouble seeing that bubbling up part. So if you want a vivid description of that, you should listen to someone other than me. Joseph Goldstein, for example. In 1975, Goldstein, along with Sharon Salzberg and Jack Kornfield, co-founded the Insight Meditation Society, where I did my first meditation retreat back in 2003. All three had traveled to Asia as young adults. All three encountered Vipassana teachings there. And all three have become important figures in Western Buddhism, teaching and writing prolifically. Goldstein's seminal 1976 book, The Experience of Insight, makes him a good person to talk to about, well, the experience of insight. Once I pressed him to describe what it's like to watch your thoughts with detachment, or as he prefers to put it, with non-attachment. What it's like to watch your thoughts. One way to get the idea, Goldstein said, is to imagine that every thought that's arising in your mind is coming from the person next to you. How would you be relating to these thoughts then? His point was that you wouldn't be identifying with them. The thought itself is appearing and disappearing like a sound, but being identified with it is something we're adding. I asked, so then in meditation, there can be the sense that thoughts are just kind of coming out of nowhere, so to speak, almost like voices? Yeah, he answered. I'm always happy to help sane people not sound like they're crazy, so I added, although it's not like you're hearing things, literally. Yeah, correct. I liked where this was heading. He seemed to be saying that thoughts which we normally think of as emanating from the conscious self are actually directed toward what we think of as the conscious self, after which we embrace the thoughts as belonging to that self. This, in turn, seemed consistent with the idea that modules generate thoughts outside of consciousness and somehow inject them into consciousness. So I pressed the point. Let me see if I have this right. During meditation, you can begin to see that, whereas you might have thought all your life that you're thinking thoughts, the thing you think of as you is thinking thoughts. It's closer to being the case that the thoughts try to capture you, the thing you think of as you. Right. They come from somewhere in your body, somewhere in your brain. Yes. So far, so good. But then I pressed the point too far for Goldstein's taste. I said, but whatever part of the brain or body you think of as you is more like the captive of the thoughts. The thoughts try to reach out and grab that. That's kind of an interesting way to describe it, and it certainly feels like that. But I would phrase it a little differently. It's just that the thoughts are arising, and there's a strong habit of mind to be identified with them. So it's not so much they have the intent to reach out and capture us, but rather there's this very strong habitual identification. This is how we've lived our lives, and it takes practice to try to break this conditioning, to be mindful of the thought rather than be lost in it. This last point. This idea that identifying with our thoughts is a habit that arose through conditioning is one I'd quibble with. I think some of our more generic illusions, including perhaps the idea that we generate our thoughts, are pretty deeply built into us by natural selection. Though they're influenced by life experiences, they're on balance closer to being instincts than bad habits, which explains why uprooting them is so hard. But I digress. The essence of Goldstein's qualification I accept. I hadn't meant that thoughts literally try to capture our attention. In fact, the modular model of the mind has led me to attribute less agency to thoughts than some meditation teachers do. Though these teachers are inclined to say that thoughts think themselves, strictly speaking, I'd say modules think thoughts. Or rather, modules generate thoughts, and then if those thoughts prove in some sense stronger than the creations of competing modules, they become thought thoughts, that is, they enter consciousness. Still, you can see how, while observing the mind during meditation, it could seem like thoughts think themselves, because the modules do their work outside of consciousness, so as far as the conscious mind can tell, the thoughts are coming out of nowhere. Anyway, the main point these meditation teachers are making is the same as the upshot of the modular mind model. The conscious self doesn't create thoughts, it receives them. And that reception, it seems, is the part of the process Goldstein had observed with much more objectivity and clarity than I'd been able to muster. The part when the thoughts enter conscious awareness, the part when they bubble up. After conveying to Goldstein that I hadn't meant that thoughts actually harbor a desire to capture our awareness, I asked whether, nonetheless, they sometimes seem like active things, not passive things. In other words, I said, they're actors in your consciousness that you've got to deal with, and you're in the habit of going along with them, but that's not necessary. Correct. And they become a lot less active when we see them for what they are. When we're not pulled into the drama of them. It's sort of like going to the movies. We go to the movies and there's a very absorbing story, and we're pulled into the story, and we feel so many emotions, excited, afraid, in love. And then we sit back and see these are just pixels of light projected on a screen. Everything we thought is happening is not really happening. It's the same way with our thoughts. We get caught up in the story, in the drama of them, forgetting their essentially insubstantial nature. Escaping this drama, seeing your thoughts as passing before you rather than emanating from you, can carry you closer to the not-self experience, to the moment when you see that there is no you in there doing the thinking or doing anything else, that moment when what seems like a metaphysical truth is unveiled. But as we saw in Chapter 5, some people say that the Buddha's original not-self teaching is best seen not as a metaphysical truth, but as a pragmatic strategy. Regardless of whether a self exists, by jettisoning parts of what you think of as yourself, you clarify your view of the world and become a better and happier person. And this pragmatic strategy of not-self, no less than the metaphysical discovery of not-self, would seem to be furthered by the kind of perspective Goldstein was describing. As he put it, when we have that basis of wisdom about the nature of thought, then we have more power to choose, okay, which thoughts are healthy, which thoughts are not so healthy, those we can let go. So far then, Vipassana meditation looks pretty good in light of the modular model of the mind, and it looks good at two very different stages on the meditative path. That first time on a cushion, when focusing on your breath seems hopeless, thanks to the intrusion of thoughts, and much later on the path, when, like Goldstein, you've acquired the ability to watch thoughts bubble into consciousness, sit there inertly, and then evaporate without carrying your mind away. In the first case, while struggling to focus, you see thoughts capture you, and in the second case, you see them fail to capture you. But in both cases, you realize that the thoughts aren't coming from you, from your conscious self. So both experiences make sense if thoughts are in fact propelled into consciousness by modules that are themselves beyond the reach of conscious awareness. In other words, if the modular model is correct, then the view of thoughts afforded us by meditation is truer than the everyday unreflective view, the view that has thoughts emanating from a CEO self. And this isn't the end of the validation that Vipassana meditation gets from the modular model. Just as the mindful view of thoughts makes sense in light of this model, so does the mindful view of feelings. As we've seen in the modular model, feelings are the things that give a module temporary control of the show. You see someone who inspires feelings of attraction, and suddenly you're in mate acquisition mode, seeking intimacy, being exquisitely considerate, maybe showing off, and in other ways becoming a different person. You see a bitter rival, and the ensuing feelings lead you to seek something different from intimacy, though showing off, depending on the circumstance, may still be in order. It stands to reason that if these feelings of attraction and affection, of rivalrous dislike, didn't get purchase in the first place, the corresponding modules wouldn't seize control. So one of the ideas behind mindfulness meditation, that gaining a kind of critical distance from your feelings can give you more control over which you is you at any given moment, makes perfect sense in light of the modular model of the mind. What fuel propels thoughts? There's a subtler, more fine-grained, and I admit, more speculative connection between the mindful view of feelings and the modular model of the mind. The first step to seeing it is to pay really close attention while you're meditating. I'm tempted to change that last sentence to read, "Pay really close attention while you're failing to meditate," because the part of meditation I'm talking about is the part when you can't focus on your breath because thoughts keep intruding. But if you're paying close attention to this failure to meditate, then, of course, it isn't a failure to meditate, because paying attention to whatever is happening is mindfulness meditation. Anyway, here's what I've noticed about thoughts that intrude when I'm trying to focus on my breath. They often seem to have feelings attached to them. What's more, their ability to hold my attention, in other words, to keep me enthralled, to keep me from noticing that they're holding my attention, seems to depend on the strength of those feelings. If you don't believe me, just sit down, close your eyes, focus on your breath, and then, once you start failing to focus on your breath, which shouldn't take long, try to focus on the things that are keeping you from focusing on your breath. And I don't mean just focus on whatever thought is distracting you. I mean, see if you can detect some feeling that is linked to the thought that is distracting you. Sometimes this connection between thought and feeling is obvious because the feelings are so strong, even primordial. If you're thinking about sleeping with your neighbor's spouse, or worried that your spouse is sleeping with your neighbor, or fantasizing about giving that neighbor what he or she deserves for sleeping with a neighbor's spouse, then the associated feelings, lust, jealousy, vengeance, are too raw and powerful to overlook. But even many of the less obviously animal, more human, meanderings of mind have feelings pretty obviously associated with them. You reflect on a recent social triumph, maybe a well-received joke you told, and it feels good, so you keep reflecting for a while, and maybe you imagine how you could have followed it up with a witty coda and vow to throw in the coda next time. You're pondering an important deadline you seem likely to miss, and you feel worried, and the worry keeps you fixated on the impending debacle until you come up with a plan of action or convince yourself the deadline's not so important anyway, after which the worry fades and the thought fades with it. Even that most cerebral of mind wanderings, wondering, seems to have feelings that accompany it. If I've sat down to meditate and I find myself indulging my curiosity about something, pondering some puzzle, and I pay close attention, I see that there's something pleasant about the pondering, a kind of continuously doled out carrot that keeps me meandering along the path of the puzzle toward a solution. and if I find that solution, I'm given a culminating burst of satisfaction as a reward. As John Ruskin put it in the 19th century, curiosity is a gift, a capacity of pleasure in knowing. At least, sometimes curiosity feels like that, like a pleasure so refined that you barely notice it. But Samuel Johnson, writing in the 18th century, put a different spin on it. The gratification of curiosity rather frees us from uneasiness than confers pleasure. We are more pained by ignorance than delighted by instruction. Sometimes that's true. Sometimes the quest to know something feels more like an urgent drive, an unsettling thirst. If you're trying to find out whether the stock market, which contains your life savings, continued its recent plunge today, that's different from wondering why the stock market crashed in 1929. If you're trying to find out whether your spouse is sleeping with your neighbor, that's different from wondering whether your neighbor's spouse is sleeping with another neighbor, and more different still, from wondering what makes spouses sleep with neighbors, or for that matter, what makes birds sing, or what makes stars shine, or what makes anything do anything. Whether curiosity is more like a desperate hunger or a delightful lure seems to depend on how directly and urgently relevant it is to our interests as defined by natural selection. The less direct and urgent the connection, the more subtle and pleasant the feeling. But the main point is just that all kinds of curiosity, ranging from a driving, headlong quest to a pleasant stroll along the byways of speculation, do seem to involve feelings. It's no surprise, then, that brain scans are showing that a curious state of mind involves activity in the dopamine system, the system involved in motivation and reward, in desire and pleasure. So this is what I take away from many hours of failing to meditate. I mean, many hours of failing to meditate and occasionally succeeding at mindfully observing this failure. Thoughts that grab my mind and carry it along with them have feelings attached, however subtle those feelings may be. I'm happy to report that this link between feeling and thought has been observed by people whose powers of meditative introspection are way better developed than mine. In June 2015, shortly after sending a rough draft of this book to my editor, I rewarded myself with a 2-week meditation retreat at the Forest Refuge, an appendage of the Insight Meditation Society that is geared toward experienced meditators. The guiding teacher for those 2 weeks was a psychotherapist and former Buddhist monk named Akinkano Mark Weber. One night during a Dharma talk, he said, "Every thought has a propellant, and that propellant is emotional." The word propellant suggests the answer to an important question. When your mind is wandering, when your default mode network is running the show, how does the network decide which module gets to propel its thought into consciousness at any given time? We've already heard references to some kind of competition among modules for dominance, references to a dog-eat-dog world that lies beyond the bounds of awareness. But what determines which dog wins? What makes one dog more powerful than another? Feelings as filing. So far as I can tell, the best candidate for that honor is feelings. Of all the thoughts engaged in subterranean competition at a given moment, maybe the thought that has the strongest level of feeling associated with it is the one that gains entry into consciousness. This is sheer conjecture and could well be wrong, but it would certainly make sense as a way for natural selection to organize the mind. After all, feelings are judgments about how various things relate to an animal's Darwinian interests. So, from natural selection's point of view, feelings would make great labels for thoughts. Labels that say things like high priority, medium priority, low priority. If you're a day away from some event that will markedly affect your social status, an important presentation, a big party you're hosting, preparation-related thoughts are high priority, hence high anxiety. But those thoughts are lower priority and the anxiety less acute if you're weeks from the event. If you and your best friend just had a huge argument, figuring out what to do and say about that is a matter of some importance. Greater importance than thinking about a casual acquaintance you may have offended. Hence the difference between feelings of inner turmoil and feelings of mild concern. In all of these cases, the feelings associated with the thoughts will be commensurate in strength to the importance of the thoughts as natural selection defines importance. And when the default mode takes over, when your mind isn't focused on talking to someone or reading a book or playing a sport or some other immersive task, it is the most important thoughts, the ones labeled with the strongest feelings, that get priority. There will be times, of course, when the most important thought competing for admission to consciousness isn't all that important. Sometimes life is blessedly free of issues that need urgent attention. In that case, the feeling linked to the thought that enters consciousness via your default mode network may not be very strong. But I suspect that if you pay close enough attention, which is a lot easier if you're meditating, you'll pretty much always sense a feeling tone, one that is on balance, positive or negative, associated with a thought that suddenly enters awareness. Because if the thought didn't have some such feeling, it wouldn't have gotten your attention in the first place. Feelings are, among other things, your brain's way of labeling the importance of thoughts. And importance, in natural selection's somewhat crude sense of the term, determines which thoughts enter consciousness. Again, I don't want to suggest that this is a consensus view within psychology. In fact, even if we confine ourselves to psychologists who have embraced a modular model of the mind, somewhat like the one I've described, there probably is no single view on what determines which modules carry the day. But this hypothesis strikes me as the most plausible one on offer. It makes Darwinian sense, and it meshes with the results of meditative introspection. And, though introspection isn't data, it's a legitimate aid in deciding which hypotheses merit further exploration. This particular hypothesis may help explain something about the path of meditative progress. As I mentioned earlier, I find it easier to view my feelings with some measure of detachment than to view my thoughts that way. And I don't think I'm an aberration. Lots of meditators seem to have an easier time with feelings than with thoughts. That would make sense if, indeed, feelings are the glue that makes thoughts stick to your consciousness, that makes you unreflectively take ownership of them. After all, presumably you can't start dissolving that glue, and so can't get any distance from your thoughts until you learn to see it clearly, learn to view feelings with some objectivity. Indeed, in this scenario, you'd have to be good at viewing even very subtle feelings with objectivity before you could view a wide variety of thoughts that way. So it stands to reason that it's quite advanced meditators, like Joseph Goldstein, who would most clearly and vividly see thoughts fail to stick, see them arise and pass away without ever finding purchase in the mind. This hypothesis, that feelings are, among other things, the mind's way of assigning priority labels to thoughts, is consistent with a broad trend in psychology over the past several decades. To quit talking about affective and cognitive processes as if they were in separate compartments of the mind, and recognize how finely intertwined they are. And this trend is yet another case where modern psychology was anticipated by ancient Buddhism. In a famous sutra called The Greater Discourse on the Destruction of Craving, the Buddha says that a mind object, a category that includes thoughts, is just like a taste or a smell. Whether a person is tasting a flavor with the tongue, or smelling an odor with the nose, or cognizing a mind object with the mind, the person lusts after it if it is pleasing and dislikes it if it is unpleasing. As we'll see a few chapters from now, the fine entanglement of affect and cognition helps make sense of one of the crazier-sounding Buddhist propositions, that the things we perceive in the world out there, trees, airplanes, pebbles, don't exist. At least, not in the sense that we naturally see them as existing. And as we'll see in the next chapter, This entanglement of affect and cognition can also help us wrestle with a conundrum I alluded to earlier. If the self doesn't exist, then what are the real dynamics of what is commonly called self-control? And what does Buddhism tell us about how to get some of this self-control? 9. Self-control. In the 18th century, the Scottish philosopher David Hume wrote that human reason is the slave of the passions. If Hume had meant by passions what we mean by that word today, his observation wouldn't be worth noting. Obviously, when we're seized by intense feelings like lust or vengeance, our reasoning faculties are not running the show. But Hume meant passions in a different sense. He meant feelings, broadly speaking. He was saying that, though rational thought plays an important role in human motivation, it is, in a certain sense, never really calling the shots. When we decide to do something, we decide on the basis of a feeling. Where did Hume get this idea? Apparently through introspection, carefully watching his mind at work. In a sense, Hume was being mindful before mindfulness was cool. Indeed, as Western philosophers go, Hume was pretty Eastern. A number of his views align almost uncannily with Buddhist thought, including an argument he mounted against the existence of the self. Some scholars have suggested that this may be no coincidence, that he may have somehow encountered Buddhist ideas, even though they had barely begun to drift westward from Asia. Certainly, the idea that feelings run more of the show than we realize is Buddhist in spirit. Now, a quarter of a millennium after Hume caught up with Buddhism, science is catching up with Hume. It has developed tools to peer into our motivational machinery, to see which parts of the brain are active when we make decisions. And Hume's ideas about the relationship of reason to feeling, long considered radical, are looking pretty good. Consider a decision as straightforward as whether to buy something. It's tempting to think of this as an exercise in rational deliberation. You look at the product and the price, and then you ask yourself a series of questions. How much would you use the product? Would the purchase take a big chunk of your cash? What else could you buy with that money? After answering such questions, you coolly weigh the factors for and against the purchase and decide. But weighing factors may not be so cool after all, according to an experiment done by cognitive scientists at Stanford, Carnegie Mellon, and MIT. They gave people real money and offered them a series of things to buy: wireless headphones, an electric toothbrush, a Star Wars DVD, and so on. As these people were shown each product and then its price, their brains were being scanned. It turned out researchers could do a good job of predicting whether someone would purchase something by watching which parts of the brain got more active and which got less active. And none of these were parts of the brain mainly associated with rational deliberation. Rather, they were parts associated with feelings. Like, for example, the nucleus accumbens, which plays a role in doling out pleasure and gets more active when people anticipate rewards or see things they like. The more active the nucleus accumbens while subjects were looking at a product, the more likely they were to buy it. On the other hand, there's the insula, which gets especially active when people anticipate pain and other unpleasant things. The more active the insula got when people were shown the price, the less likely they were to buy the product. Though weighing the pros and cons of a purchase sounds like a purely rational, even mechanical act, this experiment suggests that the way the brain actually does the weighing is through a contest of conflicting feelings. Even the factor of price, a purely quantitative index, the kind of thing that is easily fed into a computer's decision-making algorithm, ultimately enters the equation in the form of a feeling, a degree of aversion. And the stronger feeling, attraction or aversion, wins. To be sure, these feelings may be informed by reason. If you remind yourself that the last electric toothbrush you bought went unused and infer that this is the likely fate of your next electric toothbrush. Any feeling of attraction to the toothbrush may fade. If you remind yourself that the $20 they're asking for the toothbrush is less than you spent on dinner last Friday, your aversion to the price and activity in your insula may weaken. Why feeling governs thought. So reason does play a role in what a person finally does. Still, this experiment suggests that maybe reason can play that role only by influencing the ultimate motivator, feelings. As Hume put it, reason alone can never be a motive to any action of the will. Buying something ultimately comes down to feeling good about the purchase, or at least feeling better than walking away from the purchase feels. Of course, you may later regret walking away. Non-buyer's remorse is as real as buyer's remorse. But either way, the key word is remorse. The Monday morning quarterbacking comes in the form of a feeling, because that's the form the Sunday quarterbacking assumed in the first place. This all makes sense when you think about it in evolutionary terms. After all, feelings are the original motivators. Good and bad feelings are what natural selection used to goad animals into, respectively, approaching things or avoiding things, acquiring things or rejecting things. Good feelings were assigned to things like eating, and bad feelings to things like being eaten. Over time, bit by bit, animals got smarter. But the point of smarts, from natural selection's perspective, isn't to replace feelings, but rather to make them better informed. Intelligence helps animals do a more sophisticated job of figuring out what to approach or avoid, acquire or reject. That is, what to feel good about or bad about. So, over evolutionary time, though the calculations that inform our feelings get more and more elaborate, the feelings continue to be what ultimately steer us through life. We may buy a parka with a lining whose virtues we've confirmed through rigorous online research and extended contemplation. But the reason we finally buy the parka is because all that rational analysis gives us a good feeling about buying it. For that matter, the reason we started the analysis in the first place is because being cold in the winter gives us a bad feeling. Feelings tell us what to think about, and then, after all the thinking is done, they tell us what to do. Over the history of our evolutionary lineage, thinking has played a larger and larger role in action, but the thinking has always had both its beginning and its end in feelings. Another thing that can happen over evolutionary time is that feelings are assigned to more and more things. As our species became more complexly social, getting food and sex came to depend on navigating a social landscape, which included goals like forging alliances and being held in high esteem. So making friends and earning respect came to feel good, and being rejected came to feel bad. This in turn opened up new avenues of thought. Figuring out why a friend turned on you, imagining ways to impress people, and so on. Still, this growing web of feelings and thoughts was a straightforward extension of the basic value system evolution built into us to begin with, a system that prized surviving and getting our genes spread. Natural selection being the thrifty thing it is, the biology behind those feelings and thoughts was a straightforward extension of the biology embodying those original values. Brain scan studies have shown that the same parts of the brain that mediate physical pain also mediate the pain of social rejection, which helps explain why opiates and other painkillers can take the sting out of social setbacks. Even extended doses of Tylenol, one study showed, can dull the pain of social rejection. Reason and chocolate. All of which brings us to the subject of chocolate. A bar of Godiva chocolate, as it happens, was one of the items on offer in that MRI shopping study. But even if it hadn't been, I'd probably be bringing up chocolate now, because I'm trying to steer us toward the subject of self-control. And when it comes to self-control, chocolate ranks pretty high on my list of challenges, right up there with powdered sugar donuts and watching sports on TV rather than writing this book. Self-control has often been described as a matter of reason prevailing over feelings. Plato invoked the metaphor of a charioteer, the rational self, keeping horses, the unruly passions, under control. This basic idea has survived more or less intact for about 2.5 millennia. In fact, some people say that brain science has located the charioteer. The prefrontal cortex, which sits right behind your forehead, is extolled in high school textbooks and museum exhibits as the thing that makes you human. It is said to be the executive seat of the brain, endowing us with a capacity for extended reasoning and planning and self-control. You can tell that our ancestors, the Australopithecines, were lacking in these departments. Just look at the embarrassingly sharp slope of their foreheads. Certainly the prefrontal cortex is an important thing. I'm as proud of mine as the next guy. What's more, there is good reason to believe that this part of the brain plays some important role in what we think of as self-control. Studies show that the more formidable a temptation, the more activity there is in the prefrontal cortex of people who resist it. Still, if Hume is right, this prefrontal activity shouldn't be framed as it's commonly framed, as reason overcoming temptation or successfully opposing feeling. Reason has its effect not by directly pushing back against a feeling, but by fortifying the feeling that does do the pushing back. Yes, that Hershey bar looks good, and the thought of eating it feels good, but reflecting on that article you read about the toll high blood sugar takes on your body makes the thought of eating the Hershey bar guilt-inducing. And it's the guilt, not the reflection, that does direct combat with the urge to eat the candy bar. Reason alone, Hume argued, can never oppose passion in the direction of the will. Nothing can oppose or retard the impulse of passion but a contrary impulse. In this view, the prefrontal cortex isn't a kind of command module that evolution invented when we got promoted from mere animals to human beings. It's not something that finally tamed our unruly feelings and put us under rational control. No, the powers of reason embedded in the prefrontal cortex are themselves under the control of feelings. The value system embedded in the feelings, natural selection's conception of what's good and what's bad, what we should pursue and what we should avoid, continues to be, more or less, the prevailing value system. Natural selection has made us want foods with certain kinds of tastes, and has also made us want to live a long, healthy life. The struggle for self-control, in this particular case at least, is a clash between these two values and between feelings associated with these two values. If reason is to play a role in the struggle, it is only as a proxy for these values. It's the desire to live a long, healthy life that focuses our reasoning on the link between sugar consumption and longevity. And it's through this desire that the results of the reasoning can overpower the desire for the chocolate itself. It's in this sense that reason remains a slave to the passions, as Hume put it, and thus a slave to natural selection's overarching value system. The more we learn about the functioning of the brain, the more sense Hume's view makes. Joshua Green, a neuroscientist at Harvard, has written of a particular region in the prefrontal cortex called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. The DLPFC, the seat of abstract reasoning, is deeply interconnected with the dopamine system, which is responsible for placing values on objects and actions. From a neural and evolutionary perspective, our reasoning systems are not independent logic machines. They are outgrowths of more primitive mammalian systems for selecting rewarding behaviors, cognitive prostheses for enterprising mammals. In other words, as Green himself notes, Hume seems to have gotten it right. It isn't just the prefrontal cortex that's long been oversimplified. The part of the brain known as the limbic system is routinely identified as the seat of emotion, but that description is turning out to be misleading. The neuroscientist Luis Pessoa has written, "Affective brain regions participate in cognition on the one hand, and cognitive brain regions participate in emotion." In his textbook, The Cognitive Emotional Brain, Pessoa, like many writers in the history of psychology, invokes Plato's chariot image, but unlike most of them, he brings it up for the purpose of rejecting it. Does your inner judge really judge? It's no surprise that Plato's view, the idea of a purely rational charioteer, has held sway for so long. After all, when you're deciding whether to indulge in, say, chocolate, doesn't it feel as if there's a rational you that's pondering the question, a kind of judge who hears the arguments for and against buying the chocolate? On the one hand, you're a few pounds overweight. Plus, eating the chocolate this late in the day could make it harder to sleep. On the other hand, if you ate the chocolate, you'd feel energetic and could get some work done. Plus, you deserve a treat, given how hard you worked yesterday, thanks in part, perhaps, to the chocolate you ate. Having considered the arguments on both sides, you, the judge, render a verdict. Being a stern judge, you decide that, no, you cannot have the chocolate today. Or maybe on another day, being a lenient judge, you decide that you have indeed earned the chocolate bar. And court is adjourned. Or rather, court is recessed. After you buy the chocolate, you will begin adjudicating the question of whether to wait until you get home before eating it. Either way, it does feel as if there's a moment where you decide. So what's wrong with describing it this way, as a rational you adjudicating the case? I once asked this question of Rob Kurzban. Since Kurzban is among the psychologists who have suggested that maybe the self doesn't exist, I was pretty sure he'd have a way of describing the chocolate decision that didn't involve some rational you being the judge. And indeed, when I asked him what's wrong with saying something like, "I considered the pros and cons and decided not to eat the chocolate," he said that, strictly speaking, you should put it more like this. There were certain systems in your head that were designed to be motivated to eat high-calorie foods, and those systems had certain kinds of motives or beliefs or representations, and there are other systems in your head that have motivations associated with long-term health, and those systems have certain beliefs about the chocolate. In the end, modules of the second kind, modules focused on the long-term, inhibited the behavior that was being facilitated by the short-term modules. In other words, neither kind of module was more rational than the other. They just had different goals, and on this particular day, one was stronger than the other. You might ask, what exactly do we mean by stronger? Well, if Hume was right, and the drift of that shopping experiment was right, it comes down to a contest of feelings. A long-term module may generate a sense of guilt when you reach for that chocolate bar. It may also give you a feeling of pride when you resist the allure of chocolate. On the other side of the contest is the chocolate lust generated by the short-term module. But the short-term module may have subtler tactics as well. Is it, perhaps, the module that dredged up the memory of that article about the long-term benefits of antioxidants? It just thought the long-term module might find that article interesting? All of this highlights a puzzle. Why does our conscious mind have to spend time witnessing the presentation of reasons, that is, participating in the deliberation? If it's just a show trial, if it all comes down to a contest of power between modules that have summoned whatever fortifying logic might support their cause, couldn't the whole thing happen subconsciously, freeing up the conscious mind to do something constructive, like ponder the mind-body problem? Well, recall that the conscious mind, being the part of your mind that communicates with the world, seems to be a kind of public relations agent. My guess, said Kurzban, is that the reason your conscious mind observes the debate, including the winning rationale, is so that, if someone ever challenges you or asks you why you did X, Y, or Z, you'll be able to cite a plausible rationale. So if you're walking out of a store jamming a 3.5-ounce chocolate bar into your mouth, and a passerby looks at you quizzically, you can say, "This is so I can get more work done this afternoon." Presumably, the passerby will then think more highly of you than if you'd said, "I'm out of control, okay?" Sometimes the social stakes are higher than what a passing stranger thinks of you. If everyone you know finds out you've been cheating on your spouse, you can't just say, "I was driven by sexual urges that were designed by natural selection to maximize genetic legacy." Then people will go around saying you're the kind of person who cheats on a spouse. And of course, you're not that kind of person. So you need to be able to say something more like, "But you have to understand. My spouse had grown emotionally distant and wasn't meeting my deep need for companionship and intimacy." Then people will say they can't really blame you. So it helps to have already heard that side of the argument and watched it carry the day before you decide to have the dalliance. Then you're ready. This isn't to say that the only reason we're conscious of our reasoning process is so we can sell rationales for our behavior to a gullible public. Sometimes, while deliberating on a big decision, we consult with friends or family about what we should do, and this consultation will be more productive if we're already aware of some arguments for and against the decision. Of course, even here, there may be a public relations agenda. Consulting may be a way of making sure in advance that we're not going to do something that will antagonize important people in our lives, or a way of getting commitments of support from these people in case our decision antagonizes other people. But, especially when we're talking to people who have our interests at heart, consulting may actually mean consulting, seeking guidance. Either way, one virtue of your conscious mind being in touch with the reasons generated by competing modules is that you can share the reasons with others and get their feedback before making your decision. Strictly speaking, though, the way I should put it is this. You can share the reasons with others, and then their feedback will recalibrate how good or bad the two options feel. You may have noticed a trend in this chapter. The more we ponder the connection between reason and feeling, the dimmer the prospects seem for keeping our behavior under truly rational control. First, we learned that Hume seems to have been right. Our reasoning faculty isn't ever really in charge. Its agenda, what it reasons about, is set by feelings, and it can influence our behavior only by in turn influencing our feelings. Then we learned that, actually, even the term reasoning faculty suggests more in the way of orderly deliberation than is typical of the human mind. The view emerging here is that we don't so much have a reasoning faculty as reasoning faculties. Modules seem to have the ability to recruit reasons on behalf of their goals. This in turn suggests that reasoning is sometimes a euphemism for what these reasoning faculties do. Sure, one module may say something truly reasonable and well documented, like, "If you eat the chocolate, you'll have trouble sleeping." But another module may say something like, "You'll do more work if you eat the chocolate," even if history shows that what you'll actually do is peruse social media with unusual fervor. And it's hard to separate the valid reasons from the invalid reasons, because sometimes the least valid reasons feel good, and feelings tends to carry the day. But cheer up. Just because feelings are critical players in this drama doesn't mean we're powerless to intervene. In fact, we have a tool, mindfulness meditation, that's well suited to intervening at the level of feelings and altering their influence. So maybe there's hope for dealing with the challenge classically associated with self-control, the overindulgence of various kinds of appetites. In fact, it turns out there are specific meditative techniques being used to help people deal with such challenges as addiction to cigarettes. But before we get to those, it will help to understand how and why some appetites become dominant in the first place, what the evolutionary logic is behind the power they've amassed within your mind. Is self-discipline really the problem? If you smoke cigarettes, or for that matter, if you have an addiction to anything, ranging from heroin to pornography to chocolate, there has probably been at least one occasion when you deliberated at length over whether to indulge in this form of gratification. Maybe it was back when, having tried it a few times, you recognized its allure and at some level realized that it might eventually become your master. In any event, the deliberations must have at some point gone in favor of short-term gratification. And as time wore on and opportunities for gratification kept arising, you spent less and less time deliberating. The drive for immediate gratification became so strong that resistance was futile. That's the way these things work. High school football coaches have a way of describing this dynamic. They say that self-discipline is like a muscle. If you use it, it gets stronger, and if you don't, it gets weaker. This truism does seem to capture the broad pattern. If the part of you that's arguing against indulgence prevails a few times, if it gets successfully exercised, its chances of success will be better next time. Whereas if it loses a few times in a row, it will be headed toward a very long losing streak. In fact, this muscle metaphor is so apt that some psychologists who study these things have used it to describe the upshot of their findings. An interesting question these psychologists tend not to ask is why the muscle metaphor is apt. In other words, why is it that early successes at self-discipline lead to more successes, whereas early lapses lead to more lapses? If self-discipline is really good for the organism, you wouldn't expect natural selection to make it so easy for a few early lapses to destroy self-discipline. Yet there's no denying that a few injections of heroin can be the end of a productive life. Why? One way to answer the question is to depart from the useful but limiting self-discipline as muscle metaphor. Let's translate the question into modular terms. After the module favoring indulgence wins a few debates, its strength grows to a point where countervailing modules don't even bother trying to muster counterarguments. Why would natural selection design things that way, such that the winning module gets stronger and stronger? Imagine an ancestor of yours 20,000 years ago, your great-great-great, and so on, grandfather. Imagine him as a very young man. Imagine that one of his modules, roughly the one Freud called libido, is encouraging him to make sexual advances toward a woman. Another module is counseling caution, saying things like, "But maybe she'll reject your advances and you'll be humiliated, and maybe she'll tell people that she rejected your advances and you'll be further humiliated." Or if she already has a mate, the cautious module may say, "What if she tells her brawny husband about your unwanted advances and he feeds you to a lion?" Now let's say the first module wins and your ancestor makes the advances. And let's say it turns out the libidinous module was right. The advances are not rebuffed, sex ensues, and the brawny husband is none the wiser. Well, next time there's a conflict between these two voices, one counseling sexual advance and the other counseling restraint, doesn't it make sense to give the benefit of the doubt to the first voice? After all, it was right last time. And the fact that it was right suggests two things: that it's not outlandish to think women would find this particular ancestor attractive, and that this ancestor's brain is good at picking up on cues of interest projected by women. If, on the other hand, these advances had been rebuffed, and your ancestor had been humiliated and had become the laughingstock of the hunter-gatherer village, or worse still, was roughed up by a brawny husband before becoming a laughingstock, then things would be different. Then it would make sense to give the libidinous module less power next time around. and it would make sense to give the module counseling restraint more power. After all, it was right last time. The point is just that it makes sense that natural